I'm very happy now to welcome Sarah Richardson. She's a professor of the history of science and of studies of women, gender, and sexuality at Harvard University. Her new book is called Sex Itself, The Search for Male and Female in the Human Genome. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me.
What was the inspiration for this book?
Well, I was in 2005 reading my issue of Nature magazine, and I saw that the X chromosome, the human X chromosome, had been sequenced. And I wondered to myself, as a historian and philosopher of science, what do we know about the history of investigations into the X and Y chromosomes, these little agents of maleness and femaleness? And as I started looking into it, I saw that it was a fascinating story of these objects of scientific knowledge that have traded between the scientific sphere and popular culture ideas about masculinity and femininity. And as a gender studies scholar, I was naturally fascinated.
Well, the history of science, as you write about it, is so full of gender stereotypes that get projected even onto little microscopic things like chromosomes. What are some examples of the way that language has been used to project gender onto microscopic bits of our biology?
You know, data doesn't speak for itself. We have to interpret it. We have to label it. So, yes, we use language. We use metaphors. And that language and those metaphors come from our everyday experiences. So the way I think about it, science is not kind of outside of culture in an autonomous, value-free realm, but it's very much a part of human sociality. And that's part of what makes it so interesting. So examples, at the most basic level, I found that the X and Y chromosome have been thought of as the female and the male chromosome, and often described in feminized and masculinized terms, even referred to with the pronouns she and he. So we've animated them as like little males and females within the human genome. I've also looked at the ways in which those assumptions have played out in the cognitive work of science. So I've looked at the ways that thinking of the Y as the kind of host of maleness genes and the X or the double X as the location of femininity have influenced genetic models of male and female sex differences all throughout the 20th century.
And in fact, it has taken a large number of feminist scientists to call into question some of those assumptions.
Right. It might sound strange to think of a feminist scientist, right? Aren't scientists supposed to be kind of value-free? And wouldn't a feminist scientist be coming into the science looking for some sort of feminist agenda? But actually, what I'm able to show by looking at a number of really interesting figures is that scientists who've been influenced by the feminist movement, which after all has brought about an enormous transformation over the past 40 to 50 years, if not longer, in gender roles in society, scientists who've been influenced by those changes, both male and female, have brought those changing ideas about gender into their ways of thinking about the genetics of sex, so that we can track changing ideas about gender in the culture within the science itself.
Now, there are so many different ways that sexism has entered into science, and one is simply discounting the work of female scientists. You write about somebody named Nettie Stevens. Who is she?
Nettie Stevens. Well, Nettie Stevens is a rare female scientist from the turn of the 20th century. So as I mentioned, the X and Y chromosomes were discovered around 1900, and their relationship to sex was first understood through experiments with insects. In fact, a great deal of genetic research happened originally with insects. One of these scientists was Nettie Stevens, who was key in the development of the chromosomal understanding of sex. Among her innovations was the discovery, in fact, of the Y chromosome. She was the first to detect that there wasn't just an X, but also a Y, and to reveal the workings of the XY, XX, sex determining system in a whole variety of insects, including in Drosophila, the fruit fly, one of the cardinal organisms of genetics research. And her legacy is quite interesting. I spend a bit of time on it in the book. Among other things, she certainly reflects her time in that it was very difficult for her to get an academic position despite her accomplishments. It was difficult for her to get funding. And unfortunately, she died at a very young age and so was not able to leave a large impact beyond her role in discovering the sex chromosomes. But I try to look not only at what she did with great seriousness, but also to look at her legacy and how she's been remembered. And unfortunately, a lot of the remembrances of her have underplayed her role with respect to other scientists at the time who were working on the sex chromosomes. And so I try to set that straight, to really tease apart her intellectual contribution, not just in being the first to get to certain ideas, but then in further working with and mining and framing and theorizing the ideas around the genetics of sex.
Now, previous hypotheses about male and female from over 100 years ago described a spectrum from femaleness to maleness rather than a binary either-or. Was there any merit to that, and what happened to support the more binary view of gender?
That's right. So how did we think about sex before we discovered the sex chromosomes? You know, it's interesting because 100 years ago, that's not that long. Before that, the reigning theory of sex, as you said, held that sex was highly labile. It was plastic. It was changeable. It was not set at conception, but in fact could be influenced by factors in the mother's body, by which ovary the egg came from, by cytological factors in the cell, and by the larger environment. And sex was understood to be spectrum-like. That is, that there was a range of expressions of maleness and femaleness that was spectrum-like in the world. So intersex creatures were a matter of great fascination at this time. The prominent theory was the metabolic theory of sex. So it was the rate of metabolism early on that laid down these flexible pathways of masculinity and femininity. When the X and Y chromosomes arrived, it took a while for scientists to rearrange their way of thinking about sex to suit the X and Y chromosomes, which ultimately came to be understood as kind of the hard kernel of the male-female binary, at root in the genome, not labile, and as representing like a little male and a little female. And that vision of sex is unpacked over the course of the 20th century as associations between the X and femaleness and Y and maleness accumulate both within scientific research and in the wider popular culture.
I think it's worth noting that in other animals, there is more variability. I remember once studying coral reef fish, and some of those fish will turn from female into male if the protective male dies. And there is quite a bit of that in nature, although not in humans.
Right. There's nothing essential about the sex chromosomes, or what we call the sex chromosomes, in relation to sex. In the natural world, there are all sorts of strategies for achieving sex, two different morphs or different sexed morphs within a species. Like you said, in many fish, they can change sex within their own lifetime in response to environmental factors. Some species have three sexes. Some use temperature to determine sex and other elements of the environment. And even among those species that use sex chromosomes, there's nothing essential about the arrangement of those sex chromosomes in relation to maleness and femaleness. So in birds, the male is the homogametic sex. We refer to it as ZZ, and the female is the heterogametic sex, ZW. Whereas in humans, as we know, females have the two X's, they're the homogametic sex, and males have an X and a Y. So it's a reversed in humans and in birds. And I think this ambivalent relationship between the X and Y and this long search in science, really since the beginning of scientific inquiries into human nature, for the essence of maleness and femaleness is at the heart of the inquiry of the book.
We're talking to Sarah Richardson about her book, Sex Itself, The Search for Male and Female in the Human Genome. So we have this situation that you've just described. Women have two X chromosomes, men have an X and a Y. What's happened over the course of the 20th century is that all kinds of projections, as we've started to talk about, have been made onto these things. So there were all kinds of claims that having that single X chromosome, you know, the XY instead of two X chromosomes, made men smarter and superior to women in various ways. That the Y chromosome is in itself somehow masculine. That women are less capable of abstract thought and mathematics because of their chromosomal setup. All of these things sound absurd. Was there any science or pseudoscience? I mean, how did people even make these claims?
Well, what you're referring to is this theory called the greater male variability theory. And indeed, some folks even hold this theory today, so it's highly relevant. The idea was that males are more likely to vary in nature. They're more likely to be found at the high end of any trait as well as at the low end of any trait. And at the time, in the early 20th century, the issue of male and female intellectual capacity was coming to the fore as these massive changes in the gender order were coming underway. So should women approach higher education? Should they work outside the home? What role should they have as full members of as voters, right, in a civic democracy? And the question of women's intellect was thought to perhaps be able to be settled in some value-neutral way by referring to science. The greater male variability hypothesis of male genius held that males were more likely to be geniuses, and that the reason they were is because they possessed only a single X chromosome, that is. So in females, we have two X chromosomes, and they mute each other out. They dull each other, right? The exposure of the single X in males was supposed to provide a mechanism for the expression of extraordinary traits that would otherwise be dulled in a female body. And so it provided this kind of vivid mechanism for this long-standing hypothesis of greater male variability.
And so have those things been challenged? What is the reality as we know it at this point?
The greater male variability theory has been challenged, especially when it comes to intellectual traits. Now, let me say that it's certainly true that the exposure of the single X chromosome in males makes them more likely to exhibit in a full-throated way the traits on those chromosomes. So, for example, Duchenne muscular dystrophy, colorblindness, hemophilia, these are all well-known X-linked traits that are much more common in men than in women. Whether the X chromosome contains traits or genes involved in intellectual ability is a much greater problematic. So I do not think at this time that there's any evidence that the X chromosome contributes to male superiority in intellect. And in fact, the question of male superiority in intellect has been greatly challenged as test scores between females and males have totally evened out over the last 30 years. The consensus is that it's more likely the explanation for historical differences in male and female achievement is because of different access to cultural and educational resources than it is their sex chromosomes, their brains, or their hormones, right? The other point is that although it is true that males are more likely to experience intellectual disability, right, so if you look at the rates of disorders of cognition, even today, it's about 2-to-1 ratio of males to females. They are not equally as likely to be at the higher end. So that kind of facile, simplistic reasoning about higher and lower ranges of variation doesn't seem to bear out in the statistics.
There's also a whole range of things that people sometimes attribute to genetic factors that are actually social factors. And it brings up the distinction between sex and gender, which maybe you could explain. But there was one example in your book which I thought was amusing, which was, for example, male contact lens wearers tend to get more of a certain kind of bacterial infection on their eyes. And you can look for genetic susceptibility, but it turns out that they're just less likely to clean their contact lenses.
I love that example, too. If you look at lived and experienced and evidenced sex differences in the world, whether it's rates of contact lens eye infections or rates of osteoporosis, knee injury, etc., you need to ask, is this due to biology or is it due to cultural gender factors? What I found when I reviewed about a decade's worth of genomic research on sex differences is a field of research that is very focused on finding the biological correlates of observed sex and gender differences in the world without also looking at the cultural and gender underpinnings of those differences. And so I'm worried that this field of research, which is a quantitative technology, you can count up genes that differ between males and females, levels of gene expression that differs by organ, the liver, the heart, the brain, or by disease, cardiovascular disease or diabetes, if you will. But this work is happening without a lot of criticality, we should say, about the assumptions underlying it. So whereas in lots of other fields, in gender studies, certainly in sociology, all of the fields of social epidemiology, it's always important to look at social and cultural factors. In genomics, that hasn't yet happened. So I'm worried that we might reify kind of encode cultural differences as biological differences, as unfortunately, as you say, the history of the science of sex differences has done again and again.
We're talking to Sarah Richardson about her book, Sex Itself, The Search for Male and Female in the Human Genome. Can you just explain for our listeners the distinction that is made between sex and gender?
Ah, yes. That would be very important to this discussion. So sex typically refers to biological differences, including morphology, hormones, genitals, and, of course, the sex chromosomes. But gender refers to differences in the performance of sexed bodies in relation to expectations in the culture about masculinity and femininity. So a shorthand would be sex is biology and gender is culture. And this distinction is highly important to understand the multi-leveled and layered nature of gender development and sexual identity. So in approaching the question of the biology of sex difference with sophistication, it's important to understand the embodied and lived ways in which we become sexed and gendered individuals in the world.
So is there any solid basis in genetics and science for the concepts of masculine and feminine beyond the, you know, possession of different gonads and overt physical differences?
You know, the search for the biology of sex differences, as I said before, has been a centuries-long search. So I tend to see this in the larger historical perspective of a search that began looking at skeletons and pelvises and then blood and then hormones and then brains to find that essence of sex differences. So is there something we can learn from biology? Absolutely. It's part of the conversation. It's part of the toolkit for understanding the nature of sex and gender difference in the world. But it has to be part of a larger conversation. Sex and gender is also about culture. It varies across time and across cultures as well. And it also is, I would say, a kind of space that is always contested, right? So we can learn a lot from the biology of sex differences, and anyone, for a long time, I would say, gender studies scholars were not as perhaps engaged with the biology and all of the interesting findings in biology as we might be. But what I want to say with this book is that there's a critical and important conversation to happen between those who are thinking critically about the constructs of sex and gender and those who are actually doing the research themselves.
Now, one of the things that you point out in your book about the people who are doing the research themselves is some of the research is really poorly designed. And, I mean, you are a historian of science, so you are certainly conversant with the methods of science, but you're not a scientist yourself, and these things stand out, at least when you write about them for us, they stand out like sore thumbs. I mean, what are some examples of that?
Well, when I looked at the last couple of decades, we're really in the genomic age now. So in the last part of the book, I'm looking at a different era when we can analyze at a fine-grained level the quantitative differences between males and females, if that's a question we find valuable and meaningful to ask. One of the cases that I take up in the book is the claim made by some prominent researchers that males and females don't have a single human genome, but in fact have two different genomes and are so different that they're as different as different species, like humans and chimpanzees. Now, I find this fascinating, and I work through the claim in great depth and at a number of levels to historically situate it, but also to understand what's going on here. I think that the analogy between sex differences and species differences is a pernicious one that reveals some really problematic prior commitments of some scientists to a highly binary conception of maleness and femaleness. The idea that males and females are like Mars and Venus resonates, right, in this notion of males and females as like different species. I show how this model leads scientists to actually overestimate sex differences at the genomic level and make them appear more global and more pervasive and more important than they actually are at a biological functional level. So I actually argue strenuously against this kind of picture of sex differences. And we have to be thinking as we enter the genomic age, what are the models that we want to carve into our research frameworks for this age? Imagine it like a database that you're setting it up, You know, what are the categories? What are the search terms? We could reproduce this history of searching for differences, tallying up the differences between male and female, or we could be a bit patient with the data and try to listen to what it's telling us about the dynamic and convergent processes within the genome that complicate, perhaps, our received ideas about sex differences.
Well, some of the things that you describe, I remember one of them in particular, was things like doing a study but not having parallels between the male and female population. So you have a group of older men and a group of younger women,
yes,
and then you compare those two to find sex differences.
Right. So here's what I think is happening. I should mention that in addition to my own review of the literature, which was more qualitative, looking at the language used and the visual representation of data, which strongly emphasized sex differences and rarely had a kind of critical understanding of the meaning of those differences, I also discuss a study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, which showed some of the problems that you are mentioning. In this study, the biostatisticians reviewed more than 400 claims of genetic sex differences in the recent scientific literature, and they statistically reanalyzed those studies, and they looked for the integrity of the findings using a variety of non-controversial criteria for doing comparisons between subgroups. And they found that of those claims, only 37 of them were internally valid in that they were documented and nominally statistically significant. And in the end, they found only one claim that met all of their criteria for an internally sound finding of sex differences and also had been replicated in at least one other study. So we're in a moment, a kind of proliferating moment, for findings of difference, not just sex differences, but also race and ethnic differences, another topic that I work on. And these are being used as search tools to find things that are publishable and perhaps interesting from a scientific and therapeutic perspective. But within this research, there's not a lot of awareness of the methodological tools needed to do strong and sound studies of sex differences. So certainly, when there is a biologically and medically motivated context and reason to do a sex difference study, it should be done, and it should be done with the greatest of integrity, noting that there's great variation among males and among females, that factors like age, hormones, reproductive status are also cross-cutting variables. And this research should be done with an eye to affirming and drawing out well-known and well-grounded processes. What I find is that in this research, it's just a kind of rote process of applying the technology of the moment without a lot of criticality. And that's what I hope to do in this book, is to bring a higher level of conversation, a conceptual level, and also an ethical dimension to this research. Because as we've already discussed, this research on sex differences is highly charged, and it historically is part of a tradition that has been harmful to women. And so thinking really critically about research on human differences and what it is required to make it ethically and methodologically sound is going to be important as we enter the genomic age.
We're talking to Sarah Richardson about her book, Sex Itself: The Search for Male and Female in the Human Genome. Now, one of the reasons to do studies about sexual differences, gender differences, no, I guess it would be called, you'd say sex differences, specifically not gender differences, right? But one of the reasons to do these kinds of studies is because historically, studies of, for example, drug effects, studies of the heart and things like that used only male subjects. And so what we were learning about drug reactions or about the heart or about anything medical was specifically about males. And it turns out, as probably most of us know, that females sometimes have different symptoms when they're about to have a heart attack, and there's all kinds of actual differences. At the same time, as you talk about in your book, this research is kind of presenting difference where there may not be difference. I can't imagine that our stomach linings show real sex differences, or the composition of our toenail chemistry or whatever. You know, some things we are more similar than different. Is that not true? Do we know?
So to kind of develop what you've been saying, this is the crux of the matter facing women's health activists and sex difference researchers at this very moment, which is there was a movement to include women in biomedical studies. And that was a very, very critically important movement. And people may not be aware that it wasn't until 1992 that in the United States, the National Institutes of Health and the FDA began to require the inclusion of women in clinical studies. So that was a major accomplishment of the women's health movement. But think about what underpins the idea of inclusion. What underpins it is an assumption that there may be set biologically relevant and clinically relevant sex differences that must be studied. So it's critical to include women because it could be that drugs work differently on them. In the years since the institution of that law, women's health activists have gone further to demand funding for studies of sex differences at every level, from the brain to the cell to the gene, in every system, including in insects and in mice that are used as models in biomedical research. It's a kind of, I think at this point, a kind of rote search for sex differences, where the end in itself is the production of findings of sex differences, without a lot of critical discussion, as I said before, of how these kinds of claims operate politically and ideologically, and how they tend to support a certain idea of the natures of males and females as being known as fixed and very, very different, and as in need of separate repertoires of treatment from the biomedical establishment. In fact, in this process, although some sex differences have been found, in general, they've been very, very small, with evidence of high levels of variation between men and women and overlap for the trait under consideration between men and women as well. And so I'm concerned that this insistent interest in differences, which is somewhat ironically supported robustly by the women's health movement, is actually going back to some really, really problematic frames for thinking about human difference. And so I call into question this focus, which, by the way, has been ingrained in federal funding and law and various practices within the life sciences, including publication and awards and forms of prestige. And I think this new focus, which is called sex-based biology, needs to be examined by feminist analysts of science and anyone who is interested in the ethical dimensions of emerging genomic research, because it could contribute to harmful stereotypes, as the case of the conception of males and females as being like humans, the difference between humans and chimpanzees, I think suggests.
You know, the methods of science, the very nature of science itself should, and I, as you talk about, it's difficult to do this, but it should be free from social bias and ideology. So in theory, it would be possible to do studies on sex differences and then come up with actual real conclusions that are free from ideology. Are we not there yet?
So I have a different view. I agree with you that the goal of science is to cultivate as critical and skeptical an attitude as possible toward scientific findings of any type. And that includes being critical and skeptical and very transparent about the values and assumptions that are being brought to the table. However, my view, having studied the history of scientific research on sex and gender, is that it's a mistake to hope for a future in which we have somehow surgically excised human assumptions about sex and gender from the science. So I think rather that we should understand that science is a social practice, that gender research and sex research in biology is a part of a broader conversation about sex and gender in the culture, and that therefore what we should cultivate is a kind of what I call gender criticality, and that's total academia, so I apologize for that, but a kind of critical perspective where researchers who work in this field are well trained in concepts such as the sex gender distinction and some of the common pitfalls that sex difference research can fall into due to its embeddedness in this broader conversation. So actually, my goal is a science that is not free of values, but rather a science that has a robust and critical and transparent conversation about values in scientific research gathered all around it.
But I mean, let's just take an example like the heart and the spleen. It may turn out that our hearts really are different. Men's and women's hearts have some basic differences, but our spleens are exactly the same. And that's not really associated with values or ideology, is it?
It can be. It can be drawn into broader conversations about the fixedness of gender roles, right, and the naturalness of gender roles. So it is not necessarily so, but there's no way in which we can bind in advance the implications of scientific findings. Again, it's not that we should look in the science for some affirmation of our feminist values. It's not that we should never do sex difference research, but we should always be doing this research in a way well-grounded within the literature and that is not a kind of mindless search for differences. So it can be hard sometimes for people to accept a kind of argument about this that doesn't say yes or no, good or bad, to sex difference research. But I'm in fact trying to occupy that space to say, let's do this research, absolutely, but let's do it mindful of the history and the implications and the context for it.
Why do you think people are so eager to look for differences? I mean, is it as simple as the fact that the majority of us are heterosexual and we're just obsessed with mating and the kind of differences that those things bring up?
You know, I have asked myself this question so many times. I think part of it is that it's a very human narrative. We can all relate to findings of human differences, especially sex differences, because we operate implicitly or explicitly with theories of gender in the way we interact every day in the world, the very decision we make to go into a women's bathroom or a men's bathroom, the kinds of social circles that we have, the differences in the way we communicate and behave in same-gender relationships and environments versus mixed-gender environments. So we recognize that gender is a way of navigating the world, and also we're curious about our human nature and the ways in which science might inform it. And all of that is something that I accept with great wonder and great interest. It is also true that we're in an environment of still rapidly changing gender order, and we look to science to tell us something about whether what we're doing is natural or right, whether the massive changes that have happened in a very short time in the role of men and women in families and in the public sphere are right. So if you'll recall, when Hillary Clinton was running for president, the idea that she might be hormonal when hitting that button at 3 a.m. in the morning came into the conversation. So it is still the case that biology is a place we recourse to talk about some of our toughest questions and most charged issues around the human possibilities for men and women today.
We're talking to Sarah Richardson about her book, Sex Itself, The Search for Male and Female in the Human Genome. Now, there is, as we've talked about, so much pseudoscience that projects all kinds of traits onto, for example, the X and Y chromosome, and the errors that people have made because of their biases about sex and gender map to some extent onto the kind of errors that have been made historically in science about race. Talk about that a little bit.
Sure. Well, just like the search for human sex differences that I've described, there has long been an interest in human anthropomorphic differences between, or anthropological differences between different races, ethnicities, and cultures. And with the advent of genomics, we can study the population variation between ancestral populations from particular regions of the world who, for a variety of reasons, were more or less isolated from one another and so have signatures of that history in their genomes. And just like with sex, today these ancestral signatures are being mined as sources of difference and variation in the genome that could have implications for health and for various clinical interventions, as well as ways of subgrouping populations to extend the viability of commercially available therapeutics in an era where the pharmaceutical pipeline is drying up. And so this provides a parallel example of searches for difference that also have social implications and can feed into racist ideologies about essential differences between different people of different racial and ethnic ancestry. And there's been a very lively debate about these differences because, in part, of the history of racial science, of eugenics, of Nazi science that drew heavily on vicious ideas of biological difference between populations, suggesting that these differences were hierarchical, that certain people were lesser biologically, and that they should therefore occupy certain roles in society or even be eliminated from the gene pool. And so that history has motivated a really rich discussion around differences in biology. And I try to bring some of the richness from that discussion into thinking about sex differences. Ultimately, it can be valuable to look at variation in differences, but as the case of race tells us, these questions are never outside of society and outside of politics. They have an ethical context, and therefore it's an area of science where we have to be keen to track what's coming out of the laboratory and pay attention to how social assumptions and agendas can embed themselves into the science, even at the most basic level of design and interpretation and hypothesis development.
There's a pitfall that I've seen in discussions of race, which seems to be operative here in the sex discussion as well, which is the educated white male gets this sort of aura of neutrality, while everyone else is thought to be biased if they bring up issues that challenge that supposedly neutral position. So if you are a feminist scholar, you have a bias, which is the feminist agenda. But if you are a white male conservative scholar, you're somehow neutral. What does this look like in the sciences around sex differences and genetics?
Well, my favorite example of this is, which I write about in the book, is the case of Y chromosome degeneration theories. So for some reason or another, over the last decade, the idea that the human Y chromosome is degenerating, their term, not mine, that it is diminishing in size and will eventually disappear, that males are evolutionarily on the outs, has risen in the culture and also has become a keen area of scientific debate. Now, to step back, evolutionarily, it is true that the Y chromosome over the past 300 million years, since it appeared on the scene in mammals, has been shedding genes. So originally, it was just another X chromosome paired with the X, and it had 1,500 genes. And now it has, well, it's controversial, but somewhere around 50 genes, let's say. So it's greatly diminished, about 1/20th the size of the X today. And that is because, as we rehearsed before, the Y chromosome does not have a pair. So it doesn't recombine and regenerate the way that our chromosomes number 1 through 22 do, and the X chromosome is able to do in female bodies. And so it loses genes, all except those genes essential to male testes determination very early on in fetal life. So that's uncontroversial. But the idea that the Y chromosome is disappearing, and the debates about that, have exactly the shape that you just described. I discuss two prominent scientists, one who has sought over the past decade to rescue the Y chromosome, to find genes on the Y chromosome that are essential to maleness, that go beyond mere testes formation, that are in fact have special processes that regenerate and gather new genes to the Y chromosome. And he has argued that views that the Y chromosome are degenerating are facile feminist views that are designed to belittle men. And then the other character that I look at is a female and openly feminist-identified scientist from Australia who has argued that, in fact, the Y is degenerating and has proposed various models for its disappearance. And the way I describe this debate is one in which there are two scientists asking really interesting and good questions and pushing science forward, but they are also both bringing their values and cultural politics to the table. In the way that they approach the questions and the kinds of frames that they put their research in. But as you said, there's a kind of asymmetry here. The male scientist has been received as kind of objective, value-free inquirer about the Y chromosome, whereas the female scientist has been received as she said in one rich quote, a feminist ball-breaking scientist. And is kind of furthering her agenda through the science. But as I try to show, they both are bringing their values to the table in really interesting ways that, in fact, challenge all of our conceptions for thinking about how politics and science intersect. So just as you said, unfortunately, there remains an idea that bringing feminist critical values to the table is biasing in some way, whereas bringing masculinist or male championing values to the table is value-free.
Underlying all of this is something that is, I guess you would say, a human universal, which is the fear of losing power, of your group losing power. There's so much written about men feeling like they're losing power to women and whites feeling like they're losing power to everybody who's not white. And this is really, maybe it shouldn't be played out in science, but it seems that that is exactly what's happening.
Yeah, the case of the Y degeneration theories, I think, really shows this. The very interest in the idea that the Y is going extinct suggests that we're in a cultural moment of anxiety around masculinity. And here is where looking at the ebb and flow of certain scientific theories can tell us something interesting about culture. The interest in the idea that males are on the outs, I think, corresponds to a particular anxiety of felt loss of power by men in the face of gains by women in public life, in education, and in other spheres, where men are more attracted now to ideas about the evolutionary lack of adaptedness of masculinity to our contemporary age. There's a rise in ideas about male fragility in the face of climate change and increasing toxicity in the environment. And I do think that reflects what I call a kind of post-feminist masculinism, a kind of attempt to return to male centrism or the superiority of males or a certain natural view of masculinity. Think of the popularity of paleo diets today. And so it's a very, very interesting intersection between the changing gender politics and changing science, I think, with Y degeneration theories. They play into a certain fascination with and even attraction to the idea that maleness is on the outs today.
How is genome research, which is a relatively recent thing, changing the way we see ourselves as human beings, as men and women?
I think it really remains to be seen. As I said before, there are these two visions. One is one in which we begin to think of males and females as like different species, having different genomes, as being pervasively different at the genomic and the molecular level. I think there's a different vision, though, one in which we see the genome as embedded in society and the environment as kind of responsive and reactive and dynamic in relation to our changing lives over our own life course and in different contexts. And these discourses, a kind of genetic determinist one and a more socially embedded one, are going to vie with each other as the genomic age develops. I think also we're at a very emergent moment, so it's important for people to be skeptical Be curious, certainly, be engaged and learn about the science, but be skeptical about scientific results. We're in a heady moment where lots and lots of findings are going to come out that we don't yet know how to interpret, and that we don't fully understand in biological context, and that often cannot be replicated and will fall by the wayside. And so having patience and bringing a critical spirit, and also thinking always about the ethical purpose of this research and how to place it within our larger human conversation about genetic about human differences, I think is the message I'd like to get across with the book.
Sarah Richardson is a professor of the history of science and of studies of women, gender, and sexuality at Harvard University. Her new book is Sex Itself, The Search for Male and Female in the Human Genome. Thank you so much for spending all this time with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.